Today, on the exam room.
Zinc. Let's talk about that. James, does a diet rich in zinc help prevent or shorten the flu?
I think it does. Here again, you'll have people debating the evidence, and I don't think the silver bullet in the research world has yet arrived. However, this started probably 20 years ago with cold symptoms, and there's some evidence that it can help against other kinds of respiratory infections too, both with regard to shortening the duration of them and perhaps making them less likely to occur in the first place. Take that with a slight grain of salt because, as I said, I don't think the studies are the best quality.
Welcome to the Exam Room Podcast, brought to you by the Physicians Committee. Hi, I'm the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll, raising health IQs coast to coast and around the world. Hi to the Exam Roomies listening in Fargo, North Dakota, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and Munich, Germany. Wherever you are, we appreciate you helping to make the world a healthier place. This is episode 93 of season 7, number 592 overall. And today is all about the flu. How will you know if it is indeed the flu or just a common cold? And what are the top flu-fighting foods that you should be stocking up on this winter? Well, we are doing a full-blown flu Q&A with Dr. Neil Barnard to turbocharge our immune system to get us back on our feet faster. So on tap today from the Exam Room Live, we have a lot of great questions about the flu from the exam room. He's like, when should you really see a doctor? Will vitamin C speed up flu recovery, or is that just an old wives' tale? Will zinc help? Does milk actually make flu symptoms worse? And can spicy foods actually rid your body of the virus? Interesting question there. Also talking about herbal teas and the best diet for the immune system. I'll give you one guess as to what that could be. And as a reminder, you can join us live every Wednesday, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific for the Exam Room Live, YouTube, Facebook, X, you name it. We are there raising health IQs. But before we get going with the flu show today, let's look ahead to another big show. This one down in Miami on March 7th. Yeah, this is going to be a big time blast. It's going down in South Florida for Dr. Barnard's Bon Voyage Bash. And for the first time ever, Dr. Will Bolsiewicz, the fiber-fueled master himself, and I will be on stage together for a very special live episode of The Exam Room. Now, tickets to the bash, that big party, they are on sale now. And tickets to the podcast, they are going on sale very, very soon. So we're going to be at both. And we hope to see you there as well. There's a link to grab your Bash Pass right now in the episode notes. And stay tuned for more details on those podcast tickets. And now, the flu. Top symptoms and natural remedies with Dr. Neil Barnard from the Exam Room Live. Thanks for being here, my friend.
Great to see you, Chuck.
It is flu season. We are early in the flu season, but I know there are a lot of exam roomies here who have so many questions. And as a reminder, if you have a question for Dr. Barnard, we're going to be opening up the doctor's mailbag. So put your comments and questions right there, and we're going to get to as many as we can when we open up that doctor's mailbag. How big of a concern is the flu for the average person, Dr. Barnard?
Well, for the average person, I mean, you can be pretty miserable, but where it becomes a real problem is if you're up in years, or your lung function is not particularly good. In these cases, the flu can really be very, very serious.
All right, and let's talk about the flu versus the common cold. How can we tell what the difference between the two actually is? Michael sent that one in a little bit earlier. He was ready for this show.
Well, the symptoms can be really very similar, particularly at the beginning. And that's because it's not that the cold virus gives you the symptoms or the flu virus gives you symptoms. The symptoms are your body's reaction to the invading virus. So a virus is coming in, whether it's a cold or the flu, you sneeze, your nose runs. These are your body's really crude efforts to flush away an invading virus. So it's pretty nonspecific. However, if you've got a typical cold, you're really not going to have much of any fever. You're not going to be nauseated, vomiting. You're not going to have aches and pains very, very much. You're going to have a runny nose and feel crummy. If you have a fever, that's a sign that maybe it's not a cold, maybe it is the flu. If you've got nausea and vomiting, if you've got body aches, That's much more consistent with the flu, headaches where you're really getting hammered.
And Ashley has a follow-up to that. She was wondering whether having body aches always means that you have the flu.
Oh, not necessarily. You've got to look at the constellation of symptoms, because you can wake up from just having slept in a poor position or being a little bit too vigorous in your workout or whatever. There's lots of reasons why our bodies ache. But if it's generalized body aching, along with your temperatures going up a bit, along with the respiratory symptoms, that's tending you toward a diagnosis of a flu.
All right. And Rhonda is curious, how long does the flu typically last, and when should we get worried enough to go see the doctor?
Great question. Typical flu, it's going to run its course in about a week. Sometimes you're going to get a reprieve a little sooner. Sometimes it can go up to as much as 10 days. But when do you see a doctor? Basically, when you're seeing a doctor is when things are not going well. Let's say you take your temperature, and if it's hitting about 103, that's when a doctor's appointment is a pretty good idea. If you're using the centigrade system, that would be 39.4, so 39.4, something like that. That's where we start to worry. Also, just if your lung function is not good, if you're having really bad diarrhea, bad nausea and vomiting, those are all reasons why you might want to bring in a doctor. There's one other thing you can do. You might see these things they sell at every drugstore. It's called a pulse oximeter, and you put it on your finger and it'll tell you your pulse. That's good. But the other thing it does is it tells you how well your blood is oxygenating. In other words, let's say you've got influenza, it's in your lungs and the oxygen isn't getting in and you're in trouble. Or you could have COVID. You could have any kind of respiratory illness, and if the oxygen is not getting in your blood, that's not good. So the pulse oximeter, something you can buy at the store, they're very inexpensive. You put it on your finger and it'll show you instantly what your blood oxygenation is. And you want it to be 95% or something north of that, between 95 and 100. Once you're getting down to around 90, you start to think your blood oxygenation is being harmed by what's going on in your lungs. And that's where people start to make the decision to go to the emergency room.
Do you know about the mechanics of the pulse oximeter? I've always been curious how they're able to measure, you know, oxygenation of the blood just by putting something on the outside of your finger. I've never been able to figure that one out.
It doesn't prick your finger. It's not going inside. What it's doing is it's casting a light through, and you can tell based on the amount of light going through what the oxygenation is. If you have very oxygen... A laboratory could see the difference. Very oxygenated blood is bright in color. Poorly oxygenated blood is not.
All right. Let's talk about foods here. Andrew, vitamin C. I mean, my mom, for goodness sakes, anytime my brother or I ever got the sniffles, the first thing she would do is have orange juice, take Emergen-C, that supplement. Mm-hmm. Give me all the vitamin C. She was always of the belief that it could shorten the duration of the cold, the flu, even if you stub your toe. I don't really know. But Andrew is wondering whether vitamin C is actually effective here in fighting the flu.
Yes, it prevents taxol audits. It does all kinds of things. Yeah, exactly. But regarding vitamin C and colds, this goes back to Linus Pauling, who really was a genius. He had two Nobel Prizes, and he was a huge advocate for vitamin C. And toward the end of his life, he was taking 18 grams of vitamin C a day. Don't try this at home. That's a lot. That's way more than you would get in an orange or orange juice or by diet. That was through supplements. Okay, so he said it was good against colds. The research has been, I think mixed would be the word. There have been studies that have said it may reduce the likelihood of a cold occurring. Others said no. However, I think the jury has come back pretty favorable on shortening the duration of a cold. There was a good study of young people. They had hundreds of sort of college age folks. And they tracked them during cold season. And when people got a cold, they gave them a gram of vitamin C. If you go to the store, that's 1,000 milligrams. Okay, so one of those every hour for 6 hours. And then they dropped it to three times a day. And then they had a placebo group. that was not getting real vitamin C. And what they showed was quite a dramatic shortening of the colds in the people who got vitamin C. Now, a couple of cautions. One is hydrate, because you're putting a lot of vitamin C in your body. You don't want it to be affecting the kidneys. People who have a history of kidney stones, they start to get nervous about this for good reason. So hydrate a lot. Drink water with it. The second thing is, not all studies show benefit. There are some that say yes, some that say no. The preponderance of evidence is that it will shorten the duration of a cold, but you do have some that haven't really shown that. Is it safe? Yeah. Overall, it could cause your digestive tract to act up a little bit. You're reacting to that vitamin C. And do make sure that you hydrate. But apart from that, it doesn't seem to be harmful.
All right. If it wasn't vitamin C or orange juice, Mom, then she would get us the teas. It was always the herbal essence teas. Melissa is wondering whether these herbal teas can help alleviate flu symptoms as well. Has there been any studies done on this?
There have been. To tell you the truth, in my read of the literature, is it's mostly marketing with regard to herbal teas. Now, it's hot liquid. It smells nice, but apart from that, the medicinal benefit is something I haven't been convinced of.
All right. Here's an interesting one. I hadn't heard of this until Heather sent this one in. Heather is wondering whether eating spicy foods can help clear out flu-related nasal congestion. I'm assuming clearing congestion, yeah, but does that actually mean that you're getting rid of the virus any faster?
Great question. You can go to any Mexican restaurant when you're feeling fine. And if they're a little too exuberant with the jalapenos, your nose is going to run. What's happening is the capsaicins are triggering the mucus formation in the upper respiratory tract. So that's your body's natural defense against the virus. So your body starts making mucus sort of in hopes of getting rid of the viruses. So if you've already got a virus and your nose is already running, just adding hot peppers or you can get capsaicins in many forms. Does that help? Haven't seen any evidence that it does.
Yeah, but it's still vitamin J and it's tasty anyway, right? Yeah.
It's still vitamin J. That's right.
That's it, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Zinc. Let's talk about that. James, does a diet rich in zinc help prevent or shorten the flu?
I think it does. Here again, you'll have people debating the evidence, and I don't think the silver bullet in the research world has yet arrived. However, this started probably 20 years ago with cold symptoms. You've seen this product called Cold Ease in drugstores. It's a zinc gluconate product, and you take it every couple of hours, and it does seem to shorten colds. And there's some evidence that it can help against other kinds of respiratory infections too, both with regard to shortening the duration of them and perhaps making them less likely to occur in the first place. Take that with a slight grain of salt because, as I said, I don't think the studies are the best quality, but the ones that we have do show efficacy. And I have to tell you that when these products got on the market, the FDA said, looks okay to me. So there you have it.
A young viewer by the name of Elizabeth is curious about elderberries. There's a little bit of irony there. Are elderberries truly effective for preventing the flu? I hadn't heard this one before.
They do seem to be, yeah. They've actually been studied a lot. And you can get them in just about any kind of store, drugstore, health food store. They're quite widely sold. They're extracts. They're convenient. They're easy to take. And there is some evidence of efficacy, yeah.
All right. Daniel, my brother, is it safe to eat dairy products when you're experiencing flu symptoms? Now, this one is interesting.
Dairy products? I would skip them. The dairy protein for many people causes other reactions to get worse. For example, let's say you have environmental allergies. When people get away from dairy, the allergens can still be there, but their reaction to it is less. Something about the dairy protein accentuates other kinds of allergies and seems to make the immune response worse. So people very often do much, much better when they get away from dairy. When I say better, what do I mean? They're less likely to get bronchitis in cold season. They're less likely to get upper respiratory problems. Now, that said, I haven't really seen terrific double-blind trials of this either, but I have seen enough sort of anecdotal evidence that it's something that we would encourage people to get away from dairy. If you needed another reason to get away from dairy products, it's not just that it's got cholesterol and a lot of sodium and is a big source of saturated fat. Those are all kind of the usual reasons for getting away from dairy. But the dairy protein seems to elicit reactions in people, making other problems worse. So it's a good reason to pick the non-dairy milk on and put it on your cereal.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but unlike the vitamin J and the spicy foods, the jalapenos, dairy will actually increase congestion in this case as well, correct?
This is kind of one of the reasons why opera singers tend to avoid dairy products during the season of performance, because for exactly that reason, you can hear it in their voice. They're congested there. The kind of that grunge comes up. So yeah, that's exactly it.
All right. Let's talk about garlic and ginger. I love those two things. Justin, can eating garlic and ginger regularly help protect me from catching the flu?
I'm a skeptic to a lot of these things, but I have to say there is some science behind garlic. And part of the reason I say that, the garlic industry, you know, the people selling garlic extracts and so forth, have been eager to promote this, and they've done some studies. However, some of their studies are actually quite good, good quality, where they will take an extract of garlic, put it in a capsule. They'll have an absolute placebo in a capsule, and they have a pretty large randomized sample. And you can show some pretty good evidence that respiratory conditions are less common when people take the garlic compared to taking the placebo. Is there a downside? No. I mean, it's garlic, so it gets in the bloodstream, and mints will not mask the odor. But apart from that, there does seem to be some evidence of efficacy there.
All right.
And by the way, I didn't mean to say that it has to come as an extract. It works with regular garlic. It seems to work whether it's cooked or raw.
Outstanding. Mia, can soups or broth actually help when you're sick with the flu as well? Or does this kind of go back to what it was you were hinting at with the tea?
Yeah, same thing as herbal tea. With maybe one other hitch. Soups are hot liquid. If you've got a sore throat, that's good, just like with the herbal tea. Will it affect the virus? Not really. But one nice thing about soups is virtually every kind of soup that you'd ever want to take is more or less fat-free, unless it's some kind of creamy-based soup. So you're getting good nutrition. You're getting away from the fat. I'm talking about a minestrone or vegetable soup, a split pea soup, something like that. Why do I care? Because fatty foods interfere with your immune system. Fatty foods make your white blood cells not work so well. So if you decided I'm going to have mac and cheese as my comfort food when I'm feeling crummy, all that fat gets into your body and makes your white blood cells have more trouble. This started with in vitro tests where you would take white blood cells in the test tube. The more their test tube environment had lipid in it, fat in it, the worse the white cells were at being able to engulf invaders. So we've been encouraging people frankly, all the time, but if you are dealing with a cold, you want to get away from fatty foods because your immune system doesn't do very well in an oil slick.
All right, let's shift from hot soups and hot broth to hot toddies. Jima is watching on YouTube today, sent this one in at 12:18. What about a hot toddy, Dr. Barnard? That is, hold on, let me get you the recipe. Water, whiskey, lemon, and honey. Sip it as warm as you can get it. They say that my mom swears by it. If there's a study on hot toddies and the flu, man, I would be shocked. What do you think?
Are you saying that the whiskey has a good source of vitamin W, I guess, and this is going to knock out our cold? I am quite sure it makes you feel better. I'm not entirely sure that it has any effect on the on a cold or flu, and I doubt anyone's going to do a randomized trial anytime soon. So I can't give it a medical endorsement, but if it floats your boat, maybe a hot toddy's what you need that day.
Old Jack Daniels tackles the flu. All right, Rebecca at 12:21, also watching on YouTube. Does taking a shot of fire cider every day really help the immune system? What fire cider? I don't know what fire cider is. Do you?
I don't know, but I am wondering if it's cider with alcohol in it.
Mm,
that's kind of what it sounds like, because there is such a thing. Well, if it's hot cider, apple ciders in general are like every other hot thing. They're soothing to the throat and so forth. The alcohol is not going to help you.
All right. Let's see here. Let's go back. Sarah sent this one in a little bit earlier. We've talked about zinc, vitamin C, vitamin J. But Sarah's wondering whether there are any other specific vitamins or minerals that we can really eat and consume to boost the immune system.
Okay, let's go through some of these a little bit. We talked about vitamin C, and I'm going to give vitamin C a thumbs up for shortening the duration of a cold, recognizing that there have been studies on both sides of this. But even the NIH does say vitamin C may not prevent the cold, but it may shorten it once you got it. Let's talk about vitamin D. Vitamin D has been promoted for just about everything, but it does seem to help respiratory function in certain contexts. Zinc, we talked a little bit about zinc. The zinc that people have tested is not zinc in, say, whole grains. It's zinc as a commercial product, as an extract, and it does shorten colds a little bit. Beyond that, garlic also, we mentioned garlic, both garlic extracts and actual garlic seem to be helpful in preventing the incidence of respiratory infections. Beyond that, I'm going to say let's get away from certain things. We talked about dairy. That's a good idea. Getting away from fatty foods in general, that's a good idea. Why? The dairy protein seems to cause respiratory issues. The fats in general seem to impair immune function. So we've talked many, many times on this program about the value of a low-fat, completely plant-based diet. One of the great things about it is it has zero animal fat in it. And if you keep the oils low, you're getting a pretty good mix of healthful benefits.
All right. I was curious about that fire cider, Dr. Barnard. So I did some quick Googling and headed over to Wikipedia. And according to Wikipedia, fire cider is, quote, a pungent concoction that is made of apple cider vinegar, onions, garlic, and horseradish, sometimes with citrus, ginger, and hot peppers. Holy smokes. No wonder they call that fire cider. Man. Woo. My sinuses are clear just thinking about it.
So it's not an alcoholic beverage.
It is not, but man, that'll cure what ails you. Shally says that it's old New England folk medicine. Man, that is something else.
How long do you have to soak your feet in it?
I don't know, but my wife's getting her nails done this weekend. I'll find out. Oh, man, that's funny. Justin, follow up. You were talking about the importance of staying hydrated earlier. Not necessarily with fire cider, but with water. How much should we be drinking to stay hydrated to fight off those flu symptoms, Dr. Barnard?
Okay, let me give you the conventional wisdom, then I'm going to tell you why it's wrong. the conventional wisdom says 8 glasses of water per day. You've heard this. Have an 8-ounce glass of water and then repeat that 8 times a day, and you'll get the 64 ounces of water that you need for good hydration, and you need this because your body is mostly water, da-da-da-da-da. Wrong. The reason it's wrong is although you do need that amount of water, and that amount of water is very good, and hydration is really good, you're getting water in foods. You don't need to eat your normal meal and then have an extra glass of water. If you have a piece of fruit, it's got water in it. If you have a bowl of oatmeal, what did you cook it in? You cooked it in water. If you put soy milk on your morning cereal, there's water there too. So that 64 ounces of water is a good guide, not for what you need to be drinking, but for the amount your body is looking for from the foods and beverages and everything all combined that you're getting. So do push that. If you are doing vitamin C, as we were talking about earlier, you might want to hydrate a little extra. You want very dilute urine to be going through your kidneys, or you want a dilute blood to go through your kidneys so that your urine is dilute. You get the idea.
We haven't talked about protein yet and whether or not there's a correlation between the two. David is wondering how important it is to stay consistent with protein intake in order to have a healthy immune system.
I wouldn't worry about protein. You're going to be getting adequate protein. What I would worry about is the source. What we do see is that when people get their protein from plant sources, they seem to be better off in a variety of ways compared to people who get their protein from animals. Exactly the opposite of what we would used to say back in the 1950s, that animal protein is much better for you. But what really whacked the world of science on the head was a study from 2016 at Harvard University where they showed that if you substituted plant protein in place of animal protein, overall mortality went down. So instead of protein from chicken, your protein that came from plants associated with less mortality. Protein from dairy, you'd replace it with plants, less mortality. Protein from fish, replace it with plants, mortality went down. So how does that relate to immunity? Well, why were people dying more rapidly if their protein came from animal sources rather than plant sources? And what we believe is happening is that the body is more susceptible either to malignancies and other issues that can shorten our life, or that simply the immune system is disabled is too strong a word, but not as vigorous as it would be when you're getting your protein from plant sources. What's the smoking gun here? What we think it probably is, and stay tuned because I think we need more evidence here. Animal proteins and plant proteins have the same amino acids in them, the same building blocks, but the animal protein is higher in certain ones, methionine, lysine. And some researchers believe that a little is good, a lot is not good, and the animal protein is too darn high in them. So in answer to your question, you need protein. I wouldn't worry about it. I wouldn't try to get more protein, but I would make sure that the protein you're getting comes from plants.
All right, David submitted two. So going back to back with him, does consuming fermented foods improve the immune response when it comes to the flu, Dr. Barnard?
I don't think so. I have to say that now there are a lot of people who have been pushing fermented foods. I'm talking about pickled foods fermented foods of all kinds, kimchi and sauerkraut and so forth, suggesting that they're going to help the gut microbiome. And there's sort of limited evidence that that's the case. And if your gut microbiome is healthier, maybe that will help your immune system. The evidence that I've had, that I've seen, is really not particularly strong for that, I'm sorry to say. And even if you just took probiotics directly and thought, let me take this probiotic pill and build my gut microbiome just by swallowing the bacteria that are good for me, even that does not seem to particularly help. Even in the case where a person has, say, taken an antibiotic and they wiped out their gut bacteria and they need to repopulate them, they're going to take probiotics, it doesn't seem to work. Doesn't seem to help more than just the bacteria that you are going to get ambient. And in fact, in some cases, the probiotics make it worse. So we've done a real 180. We no longer recommend probiotics, even for people who have taken an antibiotic.
All right. Roxina is watching on YouTube today, sent this in at 12:22. She says, I started my journey to whole food plant-based 5 years ago and have been on it for over two. I used to get the flu two or even three times a year, but no more. Can you comment on the correlation between these two? That is an interesting revelation there.
We hear that for a lot of reasons. Part of it is you're avoiding the bad things we've been talking about. You're on a plant-based diet. You're not getting any dairy at all. So you're avoiding the dairy proteins. That makes your lungs less of a welcome mat for viruses. That's good. Sometimes a plant-based diet causes a little bit of weight loss too. When people have less body fat, they have less of the portals, if I can put it that way, that COVID uses. When COVID arrived, end of 2019, beginning of 2020, people who had more body weight were much more subject to COVID in general and severe COVID in particular. And we discovered that fat cells and fat cells in the lung tissue were where the COVID virus was entering. Thinner people just have less of that issue. On the plus side, you're not just avoiding fats and avoiding dairy products. What are you getting? You're getting antioxidant-rich foods, and those are immune boosters too.
All right, let's grab a couple of more, and then I want to switch gears and ask you about another E. coli outbreak that's happening. But first, let's grab Doris's question at 12:25. Mushroom powder has become a thing for immune function, and she adds it to her coffee in the morning. Do you think that is helpful, Dr. Barnard, for fighting the colds and the flus that are out there?
I don't know. I would be surprised if it is. Mushrooms have been investigated for boosting the immunity against other things, particularly cancer. And there has been a school of thought that mushroom consumption on a regular basis reduces the risk of breast cancer in women and other forms. And what we thought was going on was immune immune boosting from the mushrooms. Whether it affects respiratory conditions, I don't know. It piqued my interest. I'm going to have to look and see.
All right. Christy is wondering, we've been talking about supplements a little bit, whether it be for vitamin C or zinc, but is it better? Does the body absorb those nutrients better if you get them from food sources, or is a supplement actually the better route when we're fighting a virus?
Well, you know, we always say getting your nutrients from food is the way to go. And I think generally speaking, that's really good advice. However, our caveat here is take vitamin C, for example. To get the amount of vitamin C that you would want to take, that's shown to really sort of pharmacologically shorten the cold, you really can't eat that many oranges. You just can't get there. 1,000 milligrams of vitamin C is a lot. And if you're taking, say, 6 of those a day, getting there with food is not going to work. Same with zinc. With zinc, the gluconate that you get at the drugstore, that's typically going to be more than you're going to get with food. So yes, the idea of getting nutrients from food is a good idea, but there are times where the amount that you need is beyond what food's going to deliver.
And lastly, Cindy at 1228, watching on YouTube, do we need to take D3 in the winter to help us? What do you think?
If you are anywhere other than the tropics, yeah, vitamin D is a good thing to have. You know, our species began, if I can put it that way, in equatorial Africa. And we had the bad judgment to move to New Jersey. And there's just less sun in the wintertime. Or I might say North Dakota, which is where I grew up. I mean, between October and April, you're not getting sun on your skin because it's too darn cold to go outside. So getting vitamin D is good in general. And the effects are, I mean, many different effects. It does seem to be associated with reducing cancer risk. It does have a role in the immune system, as well as its famous role, which is it helps your body to absorb calcium so that your bones stay strong. So yeah, vitamin D supplement's a good idea. The amount that most doctors recommend is about 2,000 international units a day, 2,000 IUs a day. That's higher than the recommended daily allowance, but it's not high up in the toxicity level, and that's sort of the amount the doctors have kind of zeroed in on.
You know, I was just reading an article yesterday about the northernmost town in Alaska, and they were saying that the sun was going to set that day, but it would not rise again until January, just because of the way that the Earth is tilted on its axis. And so when you're talking about, what, 2.5 months or so without any kind of daylight, what do you think those residents' vitamin D's D levels would be? I would imagine they have got to be awfully low.
Well, these are all important issues. Now, on the other hand, they're not having much in the way of vegetation to eat either. So they might be getting vitamin D from that which is in a fish's body, because it's a fat-soluble vitamin. But the health of people living at the extreme climates has been something that people have explored for a long period of time, and overall their health is not really enviable. And that's largely because, well, I mean, there are many reasons. There are economic reasons and lots of others that are important. But the other reason is just that, whether we like it or not, we are a great ape, like chimpanzees and bonobos and orangutans and gorillas. And so we are suited for a tropical climate. But we've been so creative and restless that we've gotten to parts of the world where we've had to find ways to eke out our existence. But they're not necessarily health supporting without lots and lots of effort on our part to try to get the nutrients we need.
You think you could ever live in a place like that? I just say too darn cold, too darn dark all the time. I'm not sure that I could do that, Dr. Barnard.
That's what my parents were told when they moved to Fargo. Why do you want to go here? Really?
I don't know.
But on the other hand, people do call it God's country as well.
I got you. Let's shift gears as we kind of wrap things up for today. I want to talk to you. This has been all over the news recently. The next big E. coli outbreak. We just had the one at McDonald's, traced that back to onions. And now we have this other one that is affecting baby carrots, who I know that our director today, Emily, is a huge fan of. And she just can't get enough of these things, Dr. Barnard. But what surprises me is that we have this E. coli outbreak with carrots. And I know one of the things that you and I have talked about, well, the carrot's not the problem, even though it is the carrot that's got the E. coli, it's the animal industry. Can you kind of help connect the dots there?
Right. In this case, it was Grimway carrots. and it was the organic, the ones that are the healthiest of all, you know, these organic baby carrots. They're great. You know, they're good in every way, very healthful. They make a great carrot juice and so forth. And they're widely distributed throughout the United States. But they were found to have E. coli. But here's the peculiar thing. Coli is coliform, as in from the colon, the intestine. E. coli, the coli refers to the colon. Well, one of the nicest things about a carrot is it doesn't have a colon. It doesn't have an intestine at all. And E. coli is not just in the environment. It's not just in a forest or in your vegetable patch. It's specifically in the colon of animals. That's where it comes from. A chicken has a colon. So there's a lot of E. coli in chickens. There's a lot of E. coli in cows. There's E. coli in anybody with a colon, but not in plants. So how did it get on the carrots? It got on the carrots in one of two ways. The less likely way is that somebody who didn't wash their hands working in the carrot factory touched the carrots and it spread from there. Okay, possible. The much more likely way is that Americans eat 1 million chickens per hour. Each chicken lives only 6 weeks. Every 6 weeks, the chickens are all taken to slaughter, and the shed behind them is filled with chicken dung, chicken manure. It gets spaded out, and the farmers got to figure out what to do with it. And what they do with it is one of two things. They feed it to cattle. I'm not making this up. Chicken manure is fed to cattle. If you feed it, no more than about 15-20% of the cattle feed, the cows don't know it's there, and they will eat it. And yes, the farmers do that to get rid of it. Yes, it goes... I know it sounds gross, but that's what they do. But the other thing they do is they will take it and put it in a manure spreader. It's a huge truck that goes up and down the fields, and they spread the chicken dung on the fields. And so any parasite that was in the chicken now is in the field and in whatever you grow there. So the answer, I mean, it's not going to absorb into the carrot, but you've got to wash it. But that's the big problem. So if there were no animal agriculture, you would never get E. coli on a carrot.
Hmm. And that's extremely common practice, as you're pointing out. And geez Louise, it just kind of makes you think.
You know, farmers are smart people. And so if you've got a big pile of chicken dung, you want to do something with it. And if you're going to have to pay somebody to truck it away, you'd much rather just use it as fertilizer or feed it to cows or all these things. And of course, when the public hears about it, they're shocked, and appropriately so. Because you do not need manure to grow vegetables. The vegetables need nitrogen, but you don't need manure for that. Anyway, don't get me started. It's really unfortunate that this has occurred. In the meanwhile, don't stop eating vegetables. Do wash them. And if we collectively avoid animal agriculture, the world will be safer in many ways.
All right. Let's go ahead and put a pin in that, but I want to circle back one more, sneak this one in for Cindy King, who is watching today in Texas, sent this in at 12:36. I think it's a really brilliant question that maybe a lot of people are wondering. We were talking about vitamin D. She's wondering, what's the difference between the D numbers, D2, D3, D whatever? What is the difference between all of those different vitamin Ds?
Okay. Vitamin D is a really complicated thing. Your body makes sort of what I'm going to call preliminary versions of vitamin D. They go to the liver and the kidneys, and they're modified a little bit. They change. Your body changes them and then turns and then uses the vitamin D for lots of different functions in the body. So along the way, it has different names, D2, D3, and you'll see them at the drugstore in these different forms as well. People often think of D3 as sort of the animal-derived form or something like that. Bottom line, they all work. So if you see a nutritional supplement that has D2 in it, you can buy it. It's going to work fine. There are some people who say the absorption is a little better with D3. They both work.
All right. Hey, you feel like going to a party in Miami in March, Dr. Barnard? Sounds like a good idea to me.
I thought you'd never ask.
Yeah, we've got the big Bon Voyage Bash coming up in March, on March 7th in Miami. That's Dr. Barnard's Bon Voyage Bash. What is a Dr. Barnard's Bon Voyage Bash? What do we have in store?
It's the funnest party that we ever have. I got to tell you, the Holistic Holiday at Sea is about to sail. And so just before everybody gets on board, I throw a bash. And we get together and we just have fun. I hope people will come. So I'm hoping that we can put the evidence, the invitation and the information that people need, share it for folks so they can put it on their calendar and join me.
Oh, I got you covered. Join us. I'm going to be there. And it's March 7th in Miami. All you need to do is go to pcrm.org/events. That's where you can get your tickets right now. And oh, by the way, our good friend, gastroenterologist extraordinaire, Dr. Will Bulsiewicz, will be joining us. We're going to be doing a live episode of the show before the bash. So it's kind of like two parties in one. We're going to put those podcast tickets on sale very, very, very soon. But the bash tickets, I've been told, are already moving fast. So we're going to be at both the podcast and the party with you, Dr. Barnard. So everybody come in and have a great time. And it's Miami in March. I mean, come on. It doesn't get much better than that. PCRM.org/events. Man, I can't wait for this one. Going to be a good time.
It is going to be a lot of fun. I hope everyone comes in, comes down and joins us.
All right. And can't wrap up today without giving a shout out to our favorite people over at the Gregory J. Ryder Memorial Fund for supporting organizations just like ours that continue to carry on the love that Greg had for animals by promoting plant-based health and also working to end animal abuse while also emphasizing programs that promote systemic change and benefit us human beings. You can visit them online at Gregory J. Ryder Memorial Fund. That's gregoryryderfund.org. You see it there on your screen. R-E-I-T-E-R fund.org. And I'm pretty sure that specific to the E. coli conversation we were having, that is something that Allison Mahoney is definitely keenly aware of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say a huge thank you to Allison. Now, Greg was such a wonderful person. Allison has carried forward his values, his heart, in such a wonderfully generous way. And I'm so grateful to Allison. Thanks to everybody there at the Gregory Ryder Fund.
Absolutely. And I'm grateful for you, Dr. Barnard. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Chuck.
Here's something I didn't know. Maybe you'll find this interesting as well. There's a Chinese study that finds that the average adult over the age of 30 will get the flu about once every 5 years. But here's the catch. It's also possible to catch the flu multiple times because the virus changes regularly. It's a master of mutation, which is why we have all these different strains. And the CDC estimates that about 8% of the population here in the U.S. will get the flu every year. And they say children are more likely than adults to get it. Now, in addition to Dr. Barnard's tips today, the Mayo Clinic offers these practical tips as well for staying healthy. Number one, wash your hands. It seems so simple to do, but they say wash your hands with warm water and soap for at least 20 seconds. And they also suggest using a paper towel to turn off the faucet and open the bathroom door if you're using a public restroom to prevent recontamination. Number two, they say don't smoke. Do not smoke because that weakens your immune system. It makes you more susceptible to becoming ill. And if you're gonna cough and sneeze, number three here, cough and sneeze into the crook of your elbow. Keep those germs locked on your clothing instead of spreading them around. And finally, if you are sick, stay home. Give your body time to rest and don't spread those germs. It's really, really easy to do. But what the Mayo Clinic also really wants to stress is not to take the flu lightly. They point out that up to 40,000 Americans will die every year because of the flu. And that's something a lot of us don't think about because it's so prevalent. Oh, it's just the flu. But then when you think about 40,000 people dying every year, that's a lot. So that's why it's really important that we did this show today. And here's something else that you can do right now to stay healthy all year round. Set that reminder to join us every Wednesday, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific on YouTube and Facebook, or catch the replay of the Exam Room right back here first thing on Thursday and continue to raise your health IQ. And as you're poking around the internet, setting up those reminders, be sure to head over to pcrm.org/athlete to pick up your free copy of our plant-based guide for athletes. Yeah, we're going to show you how to get enough protein. It's not that hard. And also how to fuel your body for optimum performance on the field, on the track, whatever the sport may be. We're going to show you how to do it. And if you're an athlete like me who just walks around the block or takes the laundry up and down some stairs, as Dr. Jim Loomis likes to say, you're an athlete too, and you will benefit. So pcrm.org/athlete. And when you sign up for the free ebook, you'll automatically become an Exam Room VIP. And that is our Insiders Club for Exam Roomies. You'll automatically be getting our newsletter with tips and thoughts from our experts, a few words from me as well. So welcome aboard, my friends, pcrm.org/athlete to get your copy right now. And if you feel like you've raised your health IQ by a point or two today, be sure to follow and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever it is that you get your shows, and leave a 5-star rating and a nice review. There are links to do that right now in the episode notes, and it only takes just a couple of seconds. And for today, that is going to wrap things up. I want to say thank you one more time to Dr. Neil Barnard for being here as we continue to raise our health IQs and learn a lot about the flu. And for everyone here at the Physicians Committee, I am the weight loss champion, Chuck Carroll. Thank you so very much for listening. And remember, as always, keep it plant-based.